I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On September 9th, 1971, prisoners at New York's Attica Correctional Facility took control of the prison to protest their mistreatment, holding guards and civilian employees as hostages. They were hungry and living in unhealthy and unsanitary conditions. They demanded a series of reforms in their negotiations with officials. 4 days later, on September 13th, heavily armed state police, National Guard, and corrections officers took back Attica, killing 39 people, wounding more than 100, including guards. They then meted out brutal punishments on the prisoners. 43 people died during those 4 days. Our guest, Heather Ann Thompson, spent more than a decade investigating what really happened at Attica 45 years ago, and she charges a cover-up by New York State officials, including the failure to indict guards and police officers for murder. She's got a new book. It's called Blood in the Water. She's a professor of history at the University of Michigan who studies mass incarceration and its impact, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
This is not an undocumented thing 45 years ago. Certainly books, investigations, reports. Was there some key document that opened this up for you?
Well, there were quite a few. As much as we feel like we knew about Attica from memoirs and certainly some films that had been done years ago, there was a remarkable amount we didn't know. And that was in part because from the very beginning, the most important records on Attica, which were those held by the state as a result of a great deal of litigation, but also its own investigative records, were pretty much off limits. Nobody had seen them. So the journey to do the book was in part a journey to find out the records. And I was able, through sheer luck, to find quite a few what people have called smoking gun documents, which were those from the inside of the Attica investigation.
But you began this not knowing that these documents existed.
Absolutely. And had it not been for the Attica lawyers, both for the hostages and for the prisoners, there might have been nothing to look at. Thankfully, the lawyers and indeed the survivors themselves, I would be in people's living rooms and they would bring out a certain letter or a certain diary entry. And it was really the survivors and the lawyers that got me started.
And when we talk about survivors, we're talking about people who were taken hostage, but also what? Prisoners?
Absolutely. Both groups. Both who had been really victimized in this ordeal.
You describe what Attica was like 45 years ago, there, in terms of nutrition, 63 cents a day spent on feeding prisoners, given one roll of toilet paper per month. Was that typical of prisons back at that time, or was there something that made Attica an outlier?
Well, it's interesting. People think that Attica was an outlier because it was an ancient institution. It looked, in fact, much looks today as it did in 1932. But indeed, the practices at Attica were standard across New York's prisons and indeed nationally, which is why there were prison rebellions across the country and including several that preceded Attica in upstate New York.
Why, though? I mean, why the treatment of prisoners this way?
Well, of course, historically in the United States, prisoners have always been the most marginalized group of citizens. And what's interesting about the 60s is it was a moment when folks began to understand that civil rights mistreatment behind bars was worth thinking about, and that even if someone was accused of a crime and was serving time, that did not mean they lost their humanity, and that to pile on top of containment forms of deprivation and torture was immoral. So the nation was really in this moment of considering prison reform.
And what kind of prisoners were at Attica at the time? What had they done to put them in that place?
Well, like today, I think citizens conjure up very, very ugly people when they think about a maximum security facility. And certainly those people were there. But to my surprise, there were a whole lot of folks there that were there on parole violations, very, very young, 18, 19 years old. And parole violations, by the way, for things like driving without a license and so forth. And a lot of people were there for property crimes, burglary, for example, because, in fact, the real issue was their drug addiction.
Ah, it seems that this uprising, as you call it, started out of some kind of fear and confusion. It didn't seem like it was an organized taking over of the prison.
No, indeed. Whereas the governor at the time, Nelson Rockefeller, assumed that it was a conspiracy, and indeed when he investigates that, very notably he places that investigation under the Organized Crime Task Force Unit. In fact, the guys in Attica at first tried to address their issues through the system, writing letters, petitioning, and the day that this begins, I actually argue it was down to management. Management was trying to punish prisoners for an incident the night before. They decided to shut the doors to the rec yard, which effectively locked in an entire company of prisoners and the guards who were watching them, but didn't tell the guards, didn't tell the prisoners what was happening. And in that locked tunnel, sheer panic ensued. And that's what touches it off. It was a riot when it was touched off, but right. Then it very quickly becomes a rebellion.
And because the prisoners feared they were going to be beaten by the guards?
Exactly. They thought they were being essentially held in this pen for some kind of retaliation. And of course, the guards had no idea why these doors were locked. And they panicked because there's two of them, you know, with 80 prisoners.
Well, in fact, you're right. It's interesting about the COs, the corrections officers, mm-hmm. that they had complained before that there weren't enough of them. Mm-hmm. They didn't have enough the right kind of training in order to deal with this prison population.
Yes. And in fact, part of this history that I write is a labor history. Guards were working class guys from upstate New York who had been complaining for days and months and weeks to their prison management that the institution was overcrowded, it was unsafe, and that indeed the capricious rules were making their lives much harder because it was tormenting prisoners, which in turn would backfire on them.
So how did this riot become an uprising then?
Well, I mean, that's really the remarkable part of the story. Every prison has many different factions, and Attica was no different. There were different political groups. There were different racial groups. There were different ethnic groups. Indeed, there were Spanish-speaking prisoners who didn't speak English and vice versa. And within a very short amount of time, these guys moved themselves to one area of the prison. They elected representatives from each of their cell blocks, and they understood that this was a moment to bring in the outside world to really hear what prison conditions were like, and thus began 4 days of discussions and negotiations with observers called in as well to oversee this.
There were a number of incidents, not a lot, but a number of incidents of violence, including a guard that was shot and then eventually died.
Overrun, absolutely. No, and indeed, I feel that the book is very, very hard-hitting on that as well. In the initial moments of this riot, before it was a rebellion. Indeed, a young guard who was in the center of the prison was overrun, beaten very severely. And, the only reason he gets any medical attention, though, interestingly, is because the prisoners bring him outside. Indeed, they released all of the hostages that had been very severely overrun in those initial moments. But yeah, there was a lot of violence in the beginning.
But also prisoners who protected the guards and civilians who were being held hostage.
Right. Surrounded by the Muslim prisoners were those in charge of surrounding the hostages, two rings of men to make sure they weren't harmed, to make sure they had blankets, food, and so forth.
What were their demands? And they had several days worth of demands.
Yeah.
But what essentially did they want?
Essentially, basic human rights. It's remarkable for all of the political speech making in the yard. At the end of the day, one will see these lists of demands and be quite startled by how basic they are. Sufficient medical care, good medical care, for example, was a very important demand. Having guards that could speak some Spanish so that people could understand them was an important demand. Making parole rules. They had a rule for parole, which I always like to tell because people are a little shocked. You get parole, but they'd hand you an outdated phone book and say you couldn't actually leave the prison until you had secured a job, which meant writing to employers, which meant, of course, you had to pay for your paper and your pencil and your stamp, and you couldn't get out until someone from the outside had hired you from one of these letters. Well, needless to say, those rules meant you had parole, but you couldn't get out.
What's so interesting, and I don't, it's hard to imagine what would happen today in 2016 if there were a similar kind of uprising as you describe. But the press, Tom Wicker, for instance, from the New York Times was allowed inside. Mm-hmm. Lawyers, William Kunstler was allowed inside as well. Again, was that unusual for the prison officials to allow a certain kind of openness.
Well, it's interesting. There had been, again, one precedent earlier the year before. There had been a series of protests in the New York City jail system where there were outside observers that came in. Some of the same guys that were then, and women actually, then invited to Attica to be observers. This was, again, a different moment, a moment when people understood that negotiation might be wise, particularly when the state had its own employees held hostage inside.
The prison chief was a guy named Russell Oswald. Mm-hmm. What do we need to know about him?
You know, he's a very tragic figure, actually, in this story. He was a good-hearted liberal prison reformer who was caught between prisoners who wanted really immediate change and had definitely earned it, and a Rockefeller administration who felt that all those prisoners were militant troublemakers with no legitimate grievances. So he's a really tragic figure in this story, I think.
So why then, on September 13th, was the decision made to go in, retake the prison, but also to retake it with weapons?
Well, that requires a great deal of thought. It's really remarkable that this ends up happening. And the short answer is my research indicates they had every intention of doing this from the beginning. The only reason they had not gone in initially was the presence of those observers. It would have probably meant killing them as well. Rockefeller, this was his line in the
sand. Governor Rockefeller.
Governor Rockefeller. He wanted to be the president. His party had moved substantially rightward. And it was his moment to show he was tough on crime. And one of the most kind of startling pieces of information I found was that they knew going in that they were going to kill their own hostages, or that they were going to kill their own employees who were being held hostage, and did it anyway. The desire to show the prisoners who was in charge outstepped the desire to protect their own employees. And that was hard for hostages for years afterwards to really grapple with.
I mean, that's a shocking thing. I read it in your book, but to hear you say something like that,
that
they were willing to, in a sense, sacrifice the hostages, you know, fellow prison officials, officers.
Particularly when they had already immobilized the entire population on the morning they went in with this toxic tear gas, which I like to tell listeners, it's not a gas, it's a powder, and it clings to your nasal passages. And so everybody is retching and falling to the ground, and that's when they send in the shooters.
Knowing how and did the prisoners have weapons of any kind?
Well, they had makeshift weapons. You know, they had baseball bats and they had, you know, homemade shanks. But everyone's immobilized. So what's really significant is that they didn't have firearms. And within 15 minutes, thousands and thousands of bullets and buckshot spray are flying around a very small enclosure. And, you know, what's really remarkable is that state troopers were not killed simply in the crossfire of this.
And 128 people severely shot that day, September 13th, 1971. 39 people killed, including prisoners and guards. And again, our guest is Heather Ann Thompson. She's got a new book. It's called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And she's a history professor at the University of Michigan. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more of the story after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Heather Ann Thompson about her new book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. So who ordered the take back of Attica?
Well, ultimately, it is the governor, Governor Rockefeller. But he, of course, was advised by members of his own staff who play a prominent role in this story as well.
But the idea that they, and I'm stuck on this, and obviously it's such an important and critical question, which is the willingness to risk the lives of people who were not prisoners.
Well, I think he was getting a strong amount of encouragement. He was talking to the White House. The Nixon administration was very clear that it saw a revolutionary conspiracy under every rock, including in prisons. And he touches base with Nixon. Nixon thinks that it's the right thing to do. And those records, frankly, we need to know more. The little I did see indicated he was very much getting the green light from the White House.
a quote from then-President Richard Nixon. You see, it's the black business. I think this is going to have a kind of salutary effect on the future prison riots.
Right. And indeed, Ehrlichman says the 4-to-1 kill ratio should have a sobering effect. They were very explicit that this is meant to be a deterrent, even if the cost was staggering.
Some of these people who took back Attica removed their badges. What kind of weapons and what kind of ammunition did they have?
So they'd been amassing outside the prison. This is troopers from barracks across upstate New York, deputy sheriffs, parks police, and corrections officers. They were arming themselves with their official weaponry, passing it out without regard to a serial number and associating a certain weapon with a certain officer, and bringing their own weapons. And there was ammunition that had been outlawed by the Geneva Convention. There were rifles in the hands of people who had never shot them before. There were, again, the personal weapons, which dealt a great deal of trauma in the yard, and shotguns, the pellets of which are what is responsible for many of the hostage deaths.
I've seen pictures of the aftermath. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that for our listeners?
It's hard to describe it. The book itself was very difficult for me to write for that exact reason. One feels a real lack of vocabulary to capture it. It was trauma. One of the epigraphs in the beginning of the book is a prisoner. It's where the title comes from. He looks up and he says, "All I could see was blood in the water. It was a rainy, chilly day, but the blood was everywhere."
And you talk to former prisoners, former guards to paint the picture of what happened inside Attica.
I did, and many of their stories also came to me because this is David and Goliath story. They fight for 40 years to finally tell their stories, both groups, and I was able to recapture some of their experiences from the stories they told on under oath and with testimony.
Was there a prisoner in particular who you feel told you what happened in Attica that day?
You know, there were many. I mean, I can't single one out. I think one of the prisoners that stands out in a lot of people's minds in this book is Frank Big Black Smith, because he was tortured for so long. He was particularly singled out. And so his story kind of haunts the book, I think.
Well, you mentioned the word torture, and there was, after the prison is retaken by the officials, there are beatings. The inmates are stripped naked.
Yep, they're stripped naked. They're thrown into cells. Many of them have 6 bullet wounds and more. They are given no medical attention, no clothing. It is freezing. And that's when the torture begins. And it goes on for days and weeks and months. And at every level, they're trying to get help and people are trying to get help for them. But they are essentially abandoned all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States.
And what do you mean by torture?
By torture, playing Russian roulette, urinating in open wounds, law enforcement, the racial epithets. I mean, just showering people with horrendous name calling, threatening them. I mean, threatening to shoot them. Everyone believes that will happen. They've just seen a whole lot of folks killed. With Big Black Smith, he was on a table with a football under his neck. And for 6 hours, they dropped hot shells on him and told him if he dropped this football, they were going to kill him. Kicked him in his testicles, beat him so severely. I mean, these people were permanently maimed as a result of this torture.
Do we know who ordered it, or was it a more spontaneous act of revenge?
I don't think anyone ordered the torture, but the very idea that you would send in state troopers, indeed one of whom was the brother of a hostage inside, sending corrections officers, many of whom were the friends of the hostages inside, that the responsibility ultimately is at the highest levels of the state. Those people had no business being sent in there.
You charge murder. I mean, I guess there have been several investigations, and there certainly were indications that some of these guards acted way beyond their authority.
Well, indeed, this is an important thing I want to say about the book. I never call anyone a murderer, and this is not a dodge. It's literally the story. The section of the book on the state's investigation, I'm a historian. I recounted what the state knew once I found those records. Who did it believe had committed a murder? Who did it believe had committed reckless endangerment or manslaughter? And so I simply tell the reader who the state was focusing on who it believed had committed criminal acts that were a member of law enforcement. And those, and then I say, which is the truth, that those people were not indicted, whereas the state did fixate on the prisoners and ultimately indicted 62 of them. None of those people, none of those charges ended up sticking.
Well, there was the charge shortly after the retaking of Attica that prisoners had slit the throats of some of the hostages.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, the state denied that its men had killed the hostages. It went out in front of the world, front page of the New York Times, front page of the LA Times, and the AP published it across the country that the prisoners had killed the hostages. And that had a lifelong devastating effect, I believe, on prison conditions in this country. It turned the nation against this idea of prison reform.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Heather Ann Thompson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And again, she's got a brand new book. It's called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. She spent 13 years investigating what happened at Attica 45 years ago, what the official story was, and her frankly challenging of that official story based on many of the documents that she read and also people that she interviewed as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There were some people, and we'll be talking to one of them in about 10 minutes, Malcolm Bell, but there was a medical examiner who obviously was looking at the bodies and trying to determine cause of death, who seemed to be pushing back against the official story.
Yes, while there's a lot of evil in this story, there are some remarkable heroes. One of them is the coroner, a guy named John Edlund, who could see for himself when he did the autopsies that the prisoners had been killed by law enforcement, and he went public at great lifetime cost to himself. He was hounded forever after for having done that. And Malcolm Bell, who we will, I assume, hear from today, he was the guy on the inside of the investigation who very, very bravely said, look, we are not prosecuting this investigation fairly. We are only focusing on prisoners. We are not also focusing on law enforcement, even though there were deaths at those hands.
So how does the state, if that's who it is, in a sense, defy what the medical examiner says or undercuts what the medical examiner says?
Well, they tried a smear campaign. They accused him of being a communist, even though I believe he was originally a Goldwater supporter. They brought in outside folks to do new autopsies. They tried everything. And ultimately, they had to admit that these guys had been killed by law enforcement bullets and then instead said, well, that had to have happened in the crossfire. In other words, there was no intent, which is why the revelation that they knew that these guys were going to die, the hostages were going to die, is so important.
You spent a fair amount of time talking about or certainly interviewing and also writing about a guard named Michael Smith.
Yes, another one of the real heroes of this story. This is a guard who was shot four times across the abdomen and also in an arm. And he was shot by a fellow member of a fellow corrections officer and really spends a lifetime trying to have his story told along with the fellow hostages. And he's remarkable because he also really understood and supported the prisoner victims in this, and that really comes out in the story.
It does. In fact, when we first meet him in the book, I mean, it's clear that what he saw at Attica disturbed him for how the prisoners were being treated, but also being a corrections officer and wanting to do the right kind of job.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And as he sees how these guys are gunned down and how he also is dispensable, it is it's a crashing moment for so many of these people, guard, hostage, judge, lawyer, it doesn't matter. This reorients everyone's perspective because they just can't believe the level of violence.
Has there been a bond then created between the people who were shot, whether they were prisoners or guards, members of
there absolutely has been. You know, these relationships are tense, for understandable reasons. But there's critical parts of the story where, for example, the daughter of slain hostage William Quinn, the one who was really beaten so severely that he died in the first minutes of the riot, she ultimately has an opportunity. She meets the prisoners who carried her father out to get him medical care. She became close friends with friends Frank Big Black Smith. Mike Smith was with her, very instrumental in keeping the lines of communication open. And there were guards, of course, who had no interest in that relationship,
and
vice versa.
We have a tweet from Nathan. Were the hostages killed by the guards? Was there any legal redress for them or their families? I mean, in certain ways, that's what we're talking about
here. Absolutely.
No,
and in fact, they were swindled by the state. The state showed up at the houses of the widows and the surviving hostages, handed them very meager, and I do mean meager, checks, and said, you know, hopefully this will tide you over, never telling them that if they cashed those checks, they had elected a remedy in the state of New York to not sue their employers. So their fight, like the prisoners' fight, took them 40 years to be heard, and ultimately they do get a financial settlement but are still fighting for an apology and for acknowledgement of what they suffered.
When you said meager, how meager are we talking about?
Some of those checks, $72, $128.
For
the death of a father, in some cases, families with 8 children.
$72.
Yeah. Or, it varied, but it was shockingly low. Telling the surviving hostages, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. Here's a little money. And again, not telling them. And my book really shows this was another deliberate move to neutralize what the state quickly understood was a very, very bad thing.
The state is different today. I mean,
right.
Nelson Rockefeller is long gone. What do you want or even expect the state of New York to do?
I think what every survivor wants and what I want as a citizen of this country and as a historian is for them to finally open the records to Attica. This is a public institution. These are public officials, and every one of these acts took place in the public eye. We have a right to those documents. The survivors absolutely have the right to closure. And the state has said that some of this is protected, for example, grand jury testimony. But I have the inventory. I know what they have, and it's far more extensive than this grand jury testimony. They need to open the records. And I think some would argue that there still needs to be a form of truth and reconciliation on Attica because the trauma is so vast for so many.
And what has been the response of the state to you directly? As you say, you know what they have.
Right. So the response to me has been when someone's not paying attention, they've given me some files. When people start to pay attention, my requests for freedom of information are denied. And currently, my understanding is that they are promising to put some of the Attica records on a website. But there's a very important publicly available documents on the website. So that doesn't fill me with a great deal of confidence that we're opening the records in full.
Would it be fair to say, and of course this happened 45 years ago, were reforms ever instituted at Attica? I'm thinking about Attica today.
They absolutely were. In the initial aftermath, there were very important reforms brought to Attica, and indeed many New York State prisons. The problem was, because of the way Attica was spun to the public writ large in New York and nationally was moving in a very punitive direction. So these were all undone. And indeed, Attica has a terrible dual legacy. One of the legacies is that we built one of the largest prison apparatuses in the entire world, one of the most punitive. And Attica today is far worse than it was in 1971. In terms of the lockdowns, the solitary, the tensions between guards and prisoners, the terrible working conditions for guards, the terrible treatment of prisoners. But the other legacy, of course, is that there is resistance to that and that people will stand together.
So you get both things.
Exactly.
Right? It is an interesting time for this book to come out, yes, marking the 45th anniversary of the Attica Uprising, but also as a country, we begin to rethink or perhaps think for the first time about prison policies, incarceration policies, who gets charged with a crime. What is their punishment for the crime?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, and I'm very grateful for that. I hope the book helps people to see that that's exactly where we should be, because one of the greatest traumas of not understanding what happened to Attica was that a whole lot of families, suffered a criminal justice turn that I think every politician, or I should say politicians from both sides of the aisle agree, are coming to agree, was disastrous. We now have 7 7+ million people under some form of correctional control. And like in 1971, far too many of them are there for social ills such as poverty and drug addiction. And we're solving it through the criminal justice system, not the public health or education system.
We had talked about the medical examiner. And interestingly, this happened after Attica, that a number of funeral directors were actually pressured to misrepresent the how the people that they were preparing for a funeral, how they had actually died.
Oh my. I mean, I take readers into, for example, Marley's funeral home where Mrs. Cunningham, mother of lots of children, her husband had just been killed by the state. And the head of the funeral director brings her into the back room and puts his finger to his lips in a hush gesture and, you know, shows her where her husband's in fact been shot. But he's fearful because his lobby is filled with troopers who are making it clear that he better sign an affidavit. He better tell everybody that these guys had their throats slit and not shot. So there's so much cloak and dagger. It's really an extraordinary story.
You say this is really about a civil rights struggle. I mean, some might call it a riot. They might call it uprising. But you say in the sort of heart of heart, it's about a civil rights issue.
It is. And even bigger than that, it's a human rights story. It's one of the most important human rights and civil rights story of the 20th century. And there is something in that struggle for everybody. Again, whether you come from law enforcement families or whether you come from a family that has been touched by incarceration. We even have troopers in this book who are so traumatized by what they've seen done in their name that 40 years later, they come to court and testify on behalf of the people who had been shot to tell the trauma, to tell what they had seen. So everybody is part of the story.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Heather Ann Thompson, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of a new book. It's called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, of course, happening 45 years ago. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Malcolm Bell will be joining us after this very short break, former special assistant to the Attica Special Prosecutor, wrote a book called The Attica Turkey Shoot. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Heather Ann Thompson is our guest. We're talking about her new book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Joining us now is Malcolm Bell, a member of the prosecutor's team investigating possible crimes at Attica. He resigned in protest, saying the investigation suppressed the truth about what happened at Attica. And he wrote a book called The Attica Turkey Shoot. Malcolm Bell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very happy to be there.
So how did you get involved in this case?
Well, I was actually deciding I wanted to be a defense lawyer, and the best way to do that is to join a prosecutor's office and get training. So when I saw a blind ad for prosecutors, I went down, and it turned out to be the Attica investigation.
Wow. And you did charge a cover-up, I mean, based on your investigations. Based on what, as you looked into this case?
Well, I was, this was 2 years after the riot. I was hired in 1973, and I found that they'd indicted a whole bunch of inmates, but no police, even though the police had killed 10 times as many people as the inmates. And I was told, well, we just haven't gotten around to it yet, which is a pretty absurd thing to say when evidence is getting cold every day. And this is 2 years later, but I was pretty uninitiated in those days, and it didn't upset me, but I certainly noted it. And then we finally did, my office finally did get around to a systematic analysis of what troopers and a few correction officers had fired their weapons. And since there was no accountability, we didn't know which rifles were charged out to which officers.
Right.
We couldn't identify particular homicides. For instance, one rifle killed three people, and we don't know who was firing that rifle. And so we organized a second grand jury, because the first one had been indicting only inmates and was pretty, let us say, we thought it was biased. And so we got a fresh grand jury, and it was a wonderful grand jury. And they really wanted to do their job. And this would have been in the spring of 1974. It was May 74. They were impaneled. And I was presenting evidence to them 3 days a week, week after week, of all the what we call shooter cases, officers who'd fired their weapons in the direction of inmates. Some we could prove had actually killed. We could tie a specific officer to a specific inmate, and those were potential murder cases. And we had five or six or seven of them. And then we had literally dozens, I counted at least 70, cases where officers admitted that they had fired their weapons in the direction of some inmate whom they claimed was running at them with a knife or some such thing, which would have been justified. But we could prove through photographs and eyewitnesses and other evidence that nobody was running at anybody with a knife at that point. And
that's, you said, 70 people, 7-0, 70 people.
Yes, six dozen. It was astounding, and it would have been shocking if it had happened. And I believe if I'd been permitted to go ahead, that really could have happened. Mm-hmm. I talked to some of the grand jurors after the fact, and there were some who would never indict a trooper. But these were, for the most part, citizens who wanted to do their job. And to show the world that Wyoming County was a legitimate, responsible place for people to participate in law enforcement, and that was where we were heading. And I think that's why they shut me down, because my superiors realized that that's where we were heading. They didn't.
Well.
It would have been pretty devastating, especially when Rockefeller was nominated for vice president that summer. That's when they really put the lid on me.
Well, you know what? Hold on one second, and let me just turn back to Heather Ann Thompson. And is there a connection? You mentioned this. Malcolm Bell just mentioned this, the fact that then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York was running for president. He became a vice presidential nominee for the candidate that time.
I mean, absolutely. And Malcolm's extraordinary work on this, his book, The Turkey Shoot, which, by the way, is going to be re-released and with new information in it. Everyone needs to see it. You know, Malcolm's evidence was very clear that he gets shut down right at the time when the former governor can certainly not afford to have his members of law enforcement indicted for any crimes related to Attica, because he has his heart set on becoming the vice president. Mm-hmm. And I think Malcolm's evidence on that is crystal clear.
Malcolm Bell, are you telling us then guards committed murder at Attica?
Let me walk that back just a little bit. I do not know any guard who committed a murder. There was one guard who committed what I regard as either manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide. He shot somebody and the person died, but I don't think he intended to do it. No, it was troopers who definitely committed murder at Attica, as far as I'm concerned.
And you know that because, based on the evidence that you saw and the testimony that you heard?
Exactly.
Now,
and in many cases, the admissions that the officers made.
You're an attorney. You're a lawyer. Is there a statute of limitations when it comes to something like this?
For most of the crimes, there is. For murder, there is not. Some of them could still be prosecuted today, though I do not see it happening.
Why not?
I don't think there's the political will.
Do you agree with that?
There may not be enough evidence at this point, but under the law, they could still be prosecuted if somebody really wanted to do it and could really dig around for the evidence the way Heather did, dug around for her evidence, which was wonderful.
Now, Heather did include in her book, based on the discovery of some of these documents, she does include some of the names of some of these state troopers. Are you comfortable with that, Malcolm Bell?
No, I'm not. This is one point where Heather and I disagree. For me, it's very easy. As a former prosecutor, I am obligated by the law not to name these people. And I'm concerned, as Heather is concerned, about the pain that may be caused by naming them. But she has a duty as historian. I understand that I don't wholly understand the duty. I respect it. I know she struggled with the question of whether to name them, and I do not fault her for naming them. I just disagree with it.
Well, in fact, at the very beginning of your book, Heather, you talk about what an agonizing decision that was, but you made the decision.
Yeah.
As a historian?
Well, exactly. What I wanted to say about that, and thank you for that, Malcolm, I basically am very troubled by any possibility, by the way, not just the naming the names in this book, anything in this book that helps people revisit this trauma. It causes me concern. I got a text from one of the Attica guys yesterday, and I mean, he's clear he's living all of this trauma again reading this book. But the section where I write about these potential crimes committed at Attica, that section is the history of the state's investigation. The whole book is a history. And part of that history of the state's investigation is to indicate who did it think. Which prisoners did it think had killed certain other prisoners or guards, and which law enforcement officers did it think committed crimes at Attica? So I'm recounting the history, and to not do that, that's where my obligation as a historian comes in. And frankly, the only concerns that I have had expressed to me has been that I've named law enforcement. Nobody has said to me, why did you name all of these prisoners? For example, one of them who was never ultimately stood trial was accused of killing a fellow prisoner. I've named him. Two, nobody has worried about those implications. And so, again, I don't want to cause anyone harm, but my job is if I know something about that history, I feel that I must report all of it, including its warts.
Malcolm, one of the things that Heather was talking about earlier in the show, that she is convinced that the National Guard, the police, the officers knew that hostages were going to be killed, that was going to be, in a sense, the price of taking back Attica. Based on your investigation, does that sound right to you?
There's only one thing I would disagree with, and that was the implication of the National Guard.
Oh, yeah, I don't argue that either. No,
okay.
I don't argue that.
Go ahead, Malcolm.
Yeah, the Guard were heroes. Yeah, it was a cold, calculated decision that they were going to take back the prison. In my judgment, when negotiations had not reached the impasse that Rockefeller and company said they had reached, there were still things to talk about. And the hostages were at a considerable distance from the place, the part of the prison that the law enforcement people occupied. So there was no way to reach them before the inmates could have killed them all if the inmates had wanted to. Well, apparently the inmates didn't want to, at least the hostages out in D Yard. The ones up on the catwalk are another situation. Two of them had their necks cut before they could be shot. The state made a calculated judgment. It wanted its prison back, and it was going to do what it had to do. It felt it had to do. I don't think it did have to do it. The situation could have been talked out, but Rockefeller wanted to look tough to satisfy certain political necessities, he felt. And so they went in before they had to. Tear gas that Heather was talking about that they dropped, that pretty well immobilized people right off the bat. So that was one reason that you know, it may not have been a total decision of the hostages not to kill the inmates not to kill the hostages. It may have been the fact they were incapacitated. Anyway, the only people who killed hostages that day were law enforcement officials, law enforcement officers. They were shooting where they shouldn't. They were. This is a pretty loaded term, but they were out of control.
That is a pretty loaded term. Heather, you described that shortly after the retaking of Attica, the yard is cleaned. I mean, cleaned of what, evidence?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, this is what then Malcolm Bell's office has to work with. The officers had the same investigators who had retaken the prison. I mean, literally some of the same people go in to investigate the yard and they scoop up all the evidence, and they don't, as Malcolm says in his book, they don't make chalk markings where the bodies were. They don't do the due diligence, which of course makes his job much harder later on and helps to fuel that cover up.
Let me get Ed. Looks like Ed from Villanova to join us on Radio Times. Ed, go ahead. You are on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was living in New York City at the time, and if I remember right, the official story was exposed by one coroner in Attica, and I was wondering whatever happened to him. And I also remember the troopers had a big party at the local motels after all this happened.
We touched earlier, Heather, about the coroner.
Yes, his name was John Edlund, and indeed, look for a piece, I believe it's going to be out this weekend, that follows up on his story in the Rochester Democrat Chronicle by Gary Craig. It's a fascinating story. I mean, he was hounded for the rest of his life with hate mail, people angry that he had told the truth at Attica, and his family will tell us, I think, a little bit about what the cost of that was for him in this new piece.
Malcolm, have you been hounded?
No, I haven't. I've so far, I feel sort of unfairly favored. Poor John Edlund was hounded to death. He died at 57, terribly prematurely. And so far, people have left me alone, and I I'd like it to continue.
And then we called you up to be on the show. I'm sure that doesn't help. Your book is called The Attica Turkey Shoot. That's based on something that somebody said. Can you explain that, Malcolm?
Yes. The troop commander of the actual assault was Major John Monahan, who was the head of Troop A, which is the jurisdiction where Attica was. And he sent out the troopers onto the catwalks and into the tunnels to retake the prison. And before that happened, he told his men, "I do not want this to be a turkey shoot. I do not want your men to be shooting fish in a barrel." And they disobeyed.
You're saying it was a turkey shoot?
Yes.
The catwalks are important to understand, I guess, Heather.
Yes. I mean, I think that the catwalks are important to understand because it's very complicated to explain in a short amount of time. But I think what readers will see is that these moments, these tense moments when it's clear to the prisoners and hostages alike that all of their pleas for talks to continue are going to be in vain. A helicopter is circling. Gas is being dropped. And prisoners make the decision to take hostages up on the catwalk. And to surround them with so-called executioners to send a message to the state that if you come in, you're effectively going to kill your own men because we will kill them. Mm. There is a lot of testimony that on behalf of the prisoners that it was very well understood that this was meant to be a bluff. Some of the hostages believed that, and others of hostages were terrified, hoped that was true, but felt very menaced by the guys around them. And at the end of the day, that is when folks start to come in, the gas drops. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether that tactical move was a terrible mistake, right, invited the violence, or whether it was indeed in an honest attempt to hold off the retaking.
We're almost out of time here, but what do you hope your book does?
I hope that it tells stories to the survivors, sadly opening new wounds, but hopefully ultimately bringing some closure. But mostly I hope that it brings pressure on the state to finally to release the records so that everybody who was there and everyone who experienced it can know the full story.
Heather Ann Thompson, thank you for joining us today
on
Radio Times. The book is called Blood in the Water. Malcolm Bell, thank you for joining us as well.
I'm glad to do it.
And his book is called The Attica Turkey Shoot. And a tweet from Sapphire Bravo to historian Heather Ann Thompson. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.